Chemical Armaments Limitation is a case in point. The original architect of the mission was Beatman. His aim was to secure an understanding with Britain that would enable international, especially colonial, questions to be resolved collaboratively rather than through competition and confrontation. The Chancellor saw in Admiral Tirpitz's ambitious naval construction program the chief obstacle to such an understanding. But the Kaiser's personal support for the naval program and the disjointed Praetorian structure of the German executive meant that oblique manoeuvres were needed to dislodge the current policy. In order to weaken Tirpitz's grip, Beatman aligned himself with the Admiralty in its long-standing campaign against the Imperial Naval Office. The Admiralty was critical of Tirpitz's concentration on ship numbers rather than the education and training of naval personnel. He encouraged the army, which had long been starved of funds while the naval budgets ballooned, to insist on refurbishment and expansion. And, of course, he briefed Metternich, the German ambassador in London, to provide him with the ammunition he would need to persuade the Kaiser that curbing naval growth might have a more persuasive effect on London than the current policy of strength and challenge. In short, Beatman assiduously worked the various switches in the system in the hope of weaning Reich defense policy off its addiction to naval growth. Like Joseph Caillaux during the Agadir crisis, Beatman made use of a non-state go-between, the Hamburg-based shipping magnate Albert Ballin, who played a crucial role in opening up a channel of communication. Like many senior figures in the commercial and banking sector, Ballin believed utterly in the civilizational value of international trade and the criminal stupidity of a European war. Through his contacts with the British banker Sir Ernest Cassel, Ballin was able to bring to Berlin a message conveying British interest in principle in seeking a bilateral understanding on issues arising from naval armaments and colonial questions. In February 1912, Lord Haldane, the Secretary of State for War, travelled to Berlin to sound out the possibilities. Why did the Haldane mission fail? The answer is not simply German intransigence over the scale and pace of naval construction, because Beatman and, albeit reluctantly, Kaiser Wilhelm II were willing to make concessions on that front. The real sticking point was Berlin's insistence on something tangible in return, namely an undertaking of British neutrality in the event of a war between Germany and another continental power. Why were the British so unwilling to grant what was asked? The argument that they were bound by the terms of their obligations to France is flawed, because Beatman was willing to limit the proposed neutrality agreement to cases in which Germany cannot be said to be the aggressor, and expressly conceded that any agreement reached would have no application insofar as it may not be reconcilable with existing agreements which the high contracting parties have already made. The true reason for British reticence lay rather in an understandable disinclination to give away something for nothing. Britain was winning the naval arms race hands down and enjoyed unchallenged superiority. Beatman and Wilhelm wanted a neutrality agreement in exchange for recognizing that superiority as a permanent state of affairs. But why should Britain trade for an asset it already possessed? In sum, it was not ships as such that prevented an agreement, but rather the irreconcilability of perceived interests on both sides. Haldane returned from Berlin shaking his head at the confusion he had observed there. It was clear even to an outsider that Beatman had not succeeded in rallying the Kaiser and the Reich Naval Office behind his policy. But in Britain, too, powerful interests were ranged against the mission's success. From the start, it was understood in London as a purely exploratory enterprise. Haldane was obliged to travel to Berlin under the cover of an educational inquiry. He was then chairing the Royal Commission on London University, and he possessed, in the words of a British draft note to the German government, no authority to make any agreement or to bind any of his colleagues. The mission, Haldane himself reassured Jules Cambon, was about détente, not entente. In Paris, Bertie worked hard to sabotage the agreement by tipping off Poincaré and goading the Quai d'Orsay to apply pressure to London. It is telling, moreover, that the man entrusted with providing Haldane with documentation and advice during the talks was none other than Sir Arthur Nicholson, a man who had always believed that any concession to Germany risked antagonizing the Russians, whose benevolence was essential to British security. Nicholson made no secret of his hostility to the Haldane venture. "I do not myself see," he told Sir Francis Bertie, the British ambassador to Paris, in February 1912, "why we should abandon the excellent position in which we have been placed, and step down to be involved in endeavours to entangle us in some so-called understandings, which would undoubtedly, if not actually, impair our relations with France and Russia." The ambassador agreed. The Haldane mission was a foolish move, undertaken merely to silence the grey-must-go radicals. From the outset, then, there was no realistic chance that the mission would succeed. To the great relief of Nicholson and Bertie, Grey refused to consider a neutrality clause, and the Haldane talks collapsed. Ambassador Goschen wrote from Berlin to congratulate Nicholson. "You have been foremost in this good work." As Nicholson's remarks suggest, the growth of détente was constrained, at least in Britain, by bloc thinking, which was still accepted as providing the indispensable foundation for national security. Détente might offer a supplement to bloc strategy, but could not supersede it. Sir Edward Grey had put it elegantly in a speech to the House of Commons in November 1911. "One does not make new friendships worth having by deserting old ones. New friendships by all means let us make, but not at the expense of the ones we have." Precisely because so little had been invested in the Haldane mission, its collapse was easily digested, and the post-Agadir Anglo-German détente continued. Only in the light of later events did the failure to achieve a naval agreement come to appear historically significant. In the autumn of 1912, as the Balkan crisis broke, the German Foreign Secretary Kiedelin Werchter proposed to Goschen, the British ambassador in Berlin, that the two countries coordinate their response with a view to preventing the powers from falling into two hostile camps. Grey, for his part, let Beetman know that he desired intimate political cooperation with Britain. Britain and Germany joined in sponsoring the ambassadors' conference that met in London between December 1912 and July 1913. The two powers helped to broker compromise solutions to the thorniest problems arising from the First Balkan War, and they urged restraint on their respective bloc partners, Russia and Austria. Ulterior motives were in play, of course. Foreign Secretary Jago, who picked up the policy thread when Kiedelin died suddenly in December 1912, hoped that continued Balkan collaboration would counteract British dependence on the Entente powers by opening London's eyes to the aggressiveness of Russian policy in the region. Grey hoped that the Germans would continue reining in the Austrians and thereby prevent Balkan regional conflicts from threatening European peace. But neither side was prepared to make any substantial change to their respective bloc strategies. The Anglo-German Balkan détente worked in large part because it was so tightly focused on an area, the Balkan Peninsula, where neither of the two states had fundamental interests at stake. It also depended on Austria and Russia's willingness not to go to war. It was a flimsy thing without substantive content that could survive only for as long as there was no serious threat to peace. We might thus say that the potential for détente was circumscribed by the resilience of the alliance blocs. This is true enough, except in so much as it implies that the alliance blocs were solid and immovable fixtures of the international system. But it is worth noting how fragile and flux-prone many of the key decision-makers felt the alliance system was. The Austrians intermittently feared that the Germans were on the point of settling their differences with Russia and leaving their Habsburg allies in the lurch, and there was some justification for this concern, for the evidence suggests that Germany's policy of restraint vis-à-vis Vienna over the period 1910-13 merely emboldened the Russians in the Balkans without yielding an offsetting security benefit. Poincaré saw in the vacuous meetings at Baltic Port the ominous herald of a Russo-German partnership in the Balkans and on the Straits. In the spring of 1913, there was even irritation in Paris at the current flirtation between the courts of St. James and Berlin, King George V being suspected of seeking warmer relations with Germany. For Sir George Buchanan, the British ambassador in St. Petersburg, the slightest evidence of a thaw between Vienna and St. Petersburg sufficed to conjure up the horrifying prospect that Russia would abandon the Entente and join forces with Germany and Austria, as it had done in the days of the Three Emperors Leagues of the 1870s and 1880s. In the case of British relations with Russia, apprehension at the prospect of losing a powerful friend was underscored by the fear of gaining a powerful enemy. During the last 3 years before the outbreak of war, the old geopolitical tensions between Russia and Britain were coming back to the fore. There were problems all along the Sino-Central Asian frontier, from Tibet and Outer Mongolia to Turkestan and Afghanistan, but the most urgent issue was Persia. By the summer of 1912, armed Russian penetration of northern Persia was raising questions about whether the Anglo-Russian Convention could be continued in its current form. As early as November 1911, Grey warned Count Benkendorf, the Russian ambassador in London, that he might soon be forced to issue public disavowals of Russian activity in Persia, and that Russia was placing the future of the convention at risk. And this was an issue that attracted interest not just in the Foreign Office, but in Cabinet, Parliament, and the press. When Sazonov and Grey met at Balmoral in September 1912, for talks focused mainly on the Persian question, there were public demonstrations against the Russian minister. Fear for Britain's imperial future, combined with the traditional Russophobia of the liberal movement and the British press, to form a potent mix. And these concerns remained acute during 1913 and early 1914. In letters of February and March 1914 to Ambassador Buchanan in St. Petersburg, Grey commented angrily on Russian plans to construct a strategic railway across Persia and all the way to the Indian frontier. The Russians had begun to push aside British trading interests in Persia, even within the zone allotted to Britain under the terms of the convention. The situation along the Chinese frontier was hardly more encouraging. In 1912-13, dispatches from British agents reported that the Russians were fomenting unusual military activity between Mongolia and Tibet. Shipments of Russian rifles had been detected passing through Urga to Lhasa, and Russian Buryat monks were training the Tibetan army, just as the Russians pushed forward into Chinese Turkestan to establish fortified positions only 150 miles from the British garrison at Srinagar. Russia, it appeared, was waiting for the next opportunity to invade India. These perceived threats produced fine cracks in the policy fabric of the Foreign Office. In Grey's eyes, the vexatious behaviour of the Russians enhanced the value of the Anglo-German Balkan détente. It was impossible not to be struck by how easily British and German diplomats were working together, just at the moment when Sazonov's opportunist Balkan zigzagging was exasperating Russia's British partners. And Grey was supported in these reflections by his long-serving private secretary William Tyrrell, the man who saw more of the foreign secretary than any other colleague. Tyrrell had earlier favoured the anti-German policy, but he later became a convinced advocate of an understanding. The attractiveness of this option was doubtless reinforced by the awareness that since Germany had lost the naval race, the chief threat posed by Berlin had lost its sting. The return to a more flexible policy promised both to mute the Russophobe arguments of the radical opposition and to spike the guns of the Grey Must Go Brigade, who saw in the Foreign Secretary's hostility to Berlin a needless threat to British independence and European peace. But this option remained chimerical for as long as the risks of losing Russian allegiance did not seem to be offset by the benefits of closer collaboration with Germany. Until that tipping point was reached, and this did not appear imminent in 1913-14, the argument for appeasing Russia and opposing Germany continued to carry great weight. Russia was a much more dangerous foe in 1913 than she had been in 1900, especially if one viewed it through the lenses of the British policymakers, who, like their French colleagues, subscribed to an extraordinarily exaggerated assessment of Russian power. Throughout the years between the Russo-Japanese War and the July crisis of 1914, and despite much evidence to the contrary, British military attachés and experts presented what seems in retrospect an absurdly positive image of Russian military prowess. In an entirely typical report filed in September 1909, General Sir Ian Hamilton, who, as former military attaché to the Japanese forces in Manchuria, had witnessed the Russian army in action, reported that immense improvements had been made during the interim, thanks to an extraordinary advance in fire-and-move tactics. Russian troops could now be described as better fighters and keener soldiers than the Germans. Since Hamilton had also attended German manoeuvres, his words were treated with respect. In the minds of some of the key policymakers in London, the Russian threat still eclipsed that posed by Germany. "What our people fear," a senior Foreign Office functionary admitted at the beginning of December 1912, when the first Albanian crisis was at its height, "is that Germany will go to St. Petersburg and propose holding Austria in if Russia will leave the Entente. This is the real danger of the situation, not a conflict of the powers. We are sincerely afraid lest out of the hurly-burly of the crisis Russia should emerge on the side of the Triple Alliance. In Nicholson's eyes, the security of Britain and its world empire still rested on the Anglo-Russian Convention, which he wished to see elaborated, along with the French Entente, into a fully-fledged alliance. It was far more disadvantageous to have an unfriendly France and Russia than an unfriendly Germany. It is absolutely essential to us to keep on the best terms with Russia," he wrote in May 1914, "as were we to have an unfriendly or even an indifferent Russia, we should find ourselves in great difficulties in certain localities where we are unfortunately not in a position to defend ourselves. Even the slightest gesture in the direction of a rapprochement with Berlin risked compromising London's reputation for reliability, and once this was gone, there was the danger that Russia would simply abandon Britain and revert to the role of imperial rival." Underlying Nicholson's view was the conviction, widely shared in London during the last pre-war years, that the awesome expansion of Russian economic power and military strength would soon place it in a position of relative independence, rendering Britain dispensable. From this, it followed that Russia's loyalty must be bought at virtually any price. Nicholson was appalled at the role played by Sazonov in sponsoring the Serbo-Bulgarian alliance against Turkey, and more generally by Russia's egging on of the Serbian government. But these were minor annoyances compared with the catastrophe of a Russian defection. British diplomats were thus in some respects more comfortable with a situation of managed tension in the Balkans than with the prospect of a return to the Austro-Russian condominium of the pre-1903 era, which would in turn have facilitated a return to the pre-1907 situation of open Anglo-Russian global rivalry, a scenario they felt even less well-equipped to deal with in 1913 than they had been in the era of the Boer War. In the summer of 1912, Nicholson even propagated the view that Russian expansion into the Balkan region was inevitable and should therefore not be opposed by Britain. "The determination of Russia, now that she has got her finances in splendid order and reorganized her army," he told the British ambassador in Vienna, "is to reassert and re-establish her predominant position in the Balkans." Détente interacted in complex ways with the mobile architecture of the alliance blocs. It could raise risk levels by muting the awareness of risk among key political actors. The ambassador's conference in London, for which Grey took much of the credit, left him confident in his ability to solve crises and save peace, a confidence that would impede his ability to react in a timely fashion to the events of July 1914. Grey drew from the Anglo-German détente in the Balkans the lesson that Germany would continue restraining its Austrian ally, come what may. Jago and Bethmann extracted the equally problematic insight that the eyes of London had at last been opened to the true character of Russian policy on the peninsula, and that Britain would probably remain neutral if the Russians started a conflict in the region. Moreover, détente in one part of the European international system could also produce a hardening of commitments in another. Thus, for example, uncertainties about London, fueled by Anglo-German collaboration in the Balkans, affected French relations with St. Petersburg. The French government, wrote the Belgian minister to Paris in April 1913, seeks to tighten more and more its alliance with Russia, for it is aware that the friendship of England is less and less solid and effective. These reflections might seem to suggest that the pre-war European system had somehow locked itself into a position from which a war was the only way out. That would appear to be one possible deduction from the observation that even détente posed a danger to peace. But we should not forget how dynamic the system still was, or how open its future seemed to be. In the last months before the outbreak of war, it was gradually dawning on some of the most senior British policymakers that the convention with Russia over Persia might not survive its scheduled renewal in 1915. Tyrrell's view in the spring of 1913 was that Britain should tolerate the misbehavior of the Russians until the crisis in the Balkans subsided, and then, in 1914 or 1915 perhaps, get tough with them over Persia, Mongolia, and China. A gap opened between Grey and Nicholson, who by 1914 was an increasingly isolated figure. Many senior Foreign Office colleagues viewed with deepening skepticism Nicholson's unconditional attachment to the Anglo-Russian Convention. Tyrrell and Grey, and other senior Foreign Office functionaries, were deeply annoyed by St. Petersburg's failure to observe the terms of the agreement struck in 1907, and began to feel that an arrangement of some kind with Germany might serve as a useful corrective to St. Petersburg. By the spring of 1914, even Nicholson was getting the message. On the 27th of March 1914, he warned a colleague not to presume that the current constellation of powers would endure. "I think it is extremely probable that before long we shall witness fresh developments and new groupings in the European political situation." Now or never. What did all of this mean for the Germans? In answering this question, it is helpful to emphasize the ambivalence of international developments in the last 2 years before the war. On the one hand, the post-Agadir period saw a waning of tension, especially between Germany and Britain, and signs that the continental alliance blocs might in time lose their functionality and cohesion. There was thus reason to believe that détente was not merely a temporary respite from mutual hostility, but a genuine potentiality of the international system. Viewed from this perspective, a general war was anything but inevitable. On the other hand, the Agadir and Balkan crises produced a drastic stepping up of military preparedness and signs of a more aggressive Russian policy on the Balkan Peninsula, backed by Paris. And the fear that the bonds of the Entente might be loosening produced in the short term a hardening of alliance commitments, a tendency reinforced by the ascendancy across Europe of relatively belligerent policy factions. German policy reflected the incoherence and ambiguity of this larger picture. First, it is worth noting that the Germans were as impressed as everyone else by the spectacle of Russian economic growth and vitality. After his journey to Russia in the summer of 1912, Bethmann summarized his impressions for Jules Cambon in similar terms to Verneuil's account for Pichon 9 months later. The Chancellor expressed a feeling of admiration and astonishment so profound that it affects his policy. The grandeur of the country, its extent, its agricultural wealth, as well as the vigor of the population, still bereft, he remarked, of any intellectualism. He compared the youth of Russia to that of America, and it seems to him that whereas the youth of Russia is saturated with futurity, America appears not to be adding any new element to the common patrimony of humanity. From the standpoint of the most influential German military commanders, it seemed blindingly obvious that the geopolitical situation was shifting rapidly to Germany's disadvantage. Helmut von Moltke, Schlieffen's successor from January 1906, as chief of the General Staff, adopted an unswervingly bleak and bellicose view of Germany's international situation. His outlook can be reduced to two axiomatic assumptions. The first was that a war between the two alliance blocs was inevitable over the longer term. The second was that time was not on Germany's side. With each advancing year, Germany's prospective enemies, and Russia in particular, with its swiftly expanding economy and virtually infinite manpower, would grow in military prowess until they enjoyed an unchallengeable superiority that would permit them to select the moment for a conflict to be fought and decided on their own terms. There was a fundamental difference in kind between these two axioms. The first was an unverifiable psychological projection, born of Moltke's own paranoia and pessimism. The second, by contrast, though it also incorporated a measure of paranoia, was at least justified by a comparative analysis of the relative military strengths of the European powers. Moltke's concern over the deepening imbalance between the two blocs and the steady deterioration in Germany's capacity to prevail in a future conflict steadily gained in plausibility after 1910, when the Russians initiated the first major cycle of rearmament in land weapons and forces. The next escalation in European war readiness and armaments investment came in the wake of Agadir and the crisis triggered by the Balkan Wars. In November 1912, as the Russians stepped up their measures against Austria-Hungary and the French government cheered from the sidelines, the German government showed remarkable restraint. Reservists were not called up, conscript classes were not retained, there was no trial mobilization. But from mid-November, as the massive scale of the Russian military preparations became clear, the German command grew increasingly concerned. Especially alarming was the retention of the Russian senior conscript class, which sharply raised troop strength along the German frontier in the Polish salient. And these concerns were nourished by intelligence from a range of sources and locations that the dominant view among the senior echelons of the Russian army was that conflict with Austria was inevitable, and that the best time to strike was the present moment. Unnerved by these auguries and by the troop movements on both sides of the Galician border, and anxious to counter the impression that Germany was no longer interested in defending Austria-Hungary against regional threats, the German Chancellor, Theobald von Bethmann-Hollweg, delivered a 10-minute speech to the Reichstag on the 2nd of December 1912. It was a redaction, in a more concise format and a more modest register, of Lloyd George's Mansion House speech of the previous year. The Chancellor began by noting that Germany had, to date, used her influence in order to localize the war, and that hitherto it had, in fact, been localized, an observation that brought cheers from the House. There followed a carefully worded warning. If, which I hope will not be the case, insoluble difficulties then appear, it will be the business of the powers directly involved in the particular case to give effect to their claims. This applies to our allies. If in giving effect to their interests they, contrary to all expectation, are attacked from a third side and so find their existence menaced, we, in loyalty to our duty as allies, should have to take our stand firm and determined at their side. Cheers from the right and from the National Liberals. In that case, we should fight for the defence of our own position in Europe and for the protection of our own future and security. Cheers on the right. I am convinced that in following such a policy, we shall have the whole people behind us. Cheers. The Times, which published the text of the entire speech on the following day, found nothing new or sensational in the Chancellor's words. It has been perfectly clear, the paper's Berlin correspondent wrote, that Germany is both desiring peace and ensuing, that is, pursuing it. Edward Grey saw the matter very differently. In a completely unexpected move, he summoned the German ambassador, Count Lichnowsky, to his office, and informed him that in the event of a war between Germany and the Franco-Russian alliance, Britain was likely to fight on the side of Germany's enemies. Lichnowsky's report of his conversation with Grey triggered panic in Berlin, or more precisely in the Kaiser, who, ever sensitive to signals from London, claimed to discern in Grey's warning a moral declaration of war. Deeply shaken, Wilhelm ordered Moltke, Tirpitz, Chief of the Admiralty Heringen, and Admiral Müller, Chief of the Naval Cabinet, to attend him at short notice for an emergency meeting in the Royal Palace at 11 a.m. on Sunday, the 8th of December. The meeting opened with belligerent bluster from the Kaiser. Austria must be firm in dealing with Serbia, whose troops were at this time still in Albania, and Germany must support her if Russia attacked. Should this occur, the Kaiser vociferated, Germany would throw the brunt of its army against France and use its submarines to torpedo British troop ships. Towards the end of the discussion that followed, he urged that the Navy step up the pace of U-boat production, demanded that more should be done through the press to prepare the popularity of a war against Russia, and endorsed Staff Chief Helmut von Moltke's observation that war is unavoidable and the sooner the better. Historians disagree about the significance of this War Council, as it was ironically dubbed by Bethmann, who was not invited. Some have argued that the War Council of December 1912 not only revealed the continuing centrality of the Kaiser to the decision-making process, but also set the scene for a comprehensive war plan that involved placing the Navy, the Army, the German economy, and German public opinion on a war footing in preparation for the unleashing of a premeditated conflict. Others have seen the meeting as a reflex response to an international crisis, rejecting the notion that the German military and political leadership henceforth began the countdown to a pre-planned European war. Who is right? There is no doubting the belligerence of the military advice offered at the Council, and it is clear that the Kaiser seemed willing for the moment to endorse the views of his most aggressive commanders. On the other hand, the meeting did not, in fact, trigger a countdown to preventive war. The only eyewitness report of the occasion that we possess, the diary of Admiral Müller, closes its comments on the Council with the observation that its result amounted to almost zero. No national propaganda campaign followed, and no concerted effort was made to set the German economy on a wartime footing. The key figure in the drama of the 8th of December was not Wilhelm, but Bethmann, who subsequently put the Kaiser in his place and nullified the decisions taken at the conference. The War Council of the 8th of December remained an episode. By the beginning of January, the sense of crisis in Berlin had dissipated, and Wilhelm had regained his calm. Bethmann talked him out of plans for an expanded naval program. The accelerated submarine building demanded by the Kaiser never took place, and when a new crisis broke out in the Balkans in April to May 1913 over the Serbo-Montenegrin occupation of the Albanian city of Skuteri, it was apparent that Wilhelm still opposed any moves that would incur the risk of war. Far more significant than the meeting at the Neues Palais in December was the decision in the previous month to seek an unprecedented growth in Germany's peacetime military strength. The roots of the Army Bill of 1913 lay in anxiety over Germany's deteriorating security position, compounded by alarm at Russia's handling of the Balkan crisis. In a detailed memorandum of December, Moltke made the case for an ambitious program of expansion and improvement. Should a war break out, he argued, it appeared likely that Germany would face a conflict on two fronts against France and Russia, with little help from Austria and none from Italy. If, as appeared highly likely in the light of Grey's warning of the 3rd of December, Britain too were to join the fray, the Germans would be able to field 192 fewer infantry battalions in the West than Britain, France, and Belgium combined. And Russia was no longer a negligible quantity. Its power was growing from year to year. In presentations to secret sessions of the Reichstag Budget Commission during April, the generals painted a dark picture of German prospects. They saw little chance of a peaceful resolution of Germany's current encirclement and were downbeat about the German army's chances of success. The Russians would possess irreversible military superiority by 1916. The French already enjoyed superiority in strategic railways and mobilization and deployment times, whereas the Germans possessed 13 through railway lines to the common border in 1913, France had 16, all of which were double-tracked, with junction lines to bypass loops, stations, and intersections. After much haggling over details and finance, the new bill passed into law in July 1913. The peacetime army grew by 136,000 to 890,000 officers and men. Yet the new measures still failed to meet German security needs, because they triggered hikes in armaments expenditure in France and Russia that quickly offset German growth. During the first cycle of armaments expansion, it had been the Russians who had set the pace. Now it was the Germans. The 1913 Army Law was crucial to the passage in France during August 1913 of the Three-Year Law. And in Russia, the German Army Law, plus French goading, triggered the schedule of expansions and refurbishments known as the Great Programme. In March 1913, massive sums were approved by the Tsar for artillery and other armaments in a vastly ambitious scheme that would, by 1917, have increased Russian winter peacetime strength by 800,000 men, most of whom would, by contrast with the deployment plan of 1910, be concentrated in European Russia. As a consequence, the peacetime strength of the Russian army in 1914 was double that of the German, at around 1.5 million men and 300,000 more than the combined strengths of the German and Austro-Hungarian armies. By 1916-17, the Russian figure was expected to exceed 2 million. And in 1914, these measures were complemented by the French-financed Russian Strategic Railways program. Since 1905, Germany's answer to this predicament had been the Schlieffen Plan, which aimed to resolve the problem of a war on two fronts by first mounting a massive strike against France, accompanied by a holding operation in the east. Only when the situation on the Western Front had been resolved would Germany swing eastwards against Russia. But what if the balance of forces between the two alliance blocs shifted to the point where the Schlieffen Plan no longer made sense? It has been pointed out that Germany was faster to implement its improvements than its two Entente opponents, and that this furnished the German military leadership with a short-term strategic advantage in 1914. And the economic foundations of Russia's military might remained fragile. Between 1900 and 1913, Russian productive strength was actually decreasing in relation to Germany's. But the outlook from Berlin's standpoint remained grim. In 1904, the combined strength of the Franco-Russian military had exceeded the Austro-German by 260,982. By 1914, the gap was estimated at around 1 million, and it was widening fast. In a report dated the 25th of May, 1914, the German military attaché in St. Petersburg reported the latest enlargement of the recruit contingent, from 455,000 to 585,000, and calculated expected growth in peacetime strength over the next 3 to 4 years, concluding that the growth of the Russian army will thereby increase at a rate never seen before in the armed forces of any country. Moltke viewed the Franco-Russian loan as one of the most sensitive strategic blows that France has dealt us since the War of 1870-71, and foresaw that it would bring about a decisive turning point to Germany's disadvantage. By 1916-17, German strategists believed, the striking power of Russia would be sufficient to nullify the calculations embodied in the Schlieffen Plan. Obsessed with the dangers looming from east and west, and convinced that time was running out, Moltke became the eloquent exponent of a preventive war that would enable the German Empire to resolve the coming conflict on terms advantageous to itself. He came to view each passing pre-war crisis as a failed opportunity to redress a deepening strategic imbalance that would soon place Germany at an irreversible disadvantage. Preventive war thinking became widespread within the military command. A recent study has identified several dozen occasions on which senior commanders pressed for war sooner rather than later, even if this involved taking the initiative and accepting the opprobrium of the aggressor. It was not just the Germans who saw the matter thus. Early in 1914, Poincaré remarked to the editor of Le Matin that the Germans feared the growth of Russia. They know that this great body gains each day in cohesion. They want to attack and destroy it before it has attained the plenitude of its power. In March 1914, when a summary of a dispatch outlining the improvements made to the Russian army since 1913 was sent to the British Director of Military Operations, Major General Henry Wilson, Wilson appended the following comment: "This is a most important dispatch. It is easy to understand now why Germany is cautious about the future, and why she may think that it is a case of now or never." A vein of fatalism underlay the bellicism of the German military. When they spoke of war, the German military tended to speak less of victory than of the twin threats of defeat and annihilation. The danger inherent in such thinking, which allowed commanders to sanction even the most aggressive initiatives as essentially defensive, is clear enough. But to what extent did the preventive war arguments of the military shape German foreign policy? Even in a Praetorian system like the Prusso-German one, much depended on the ability of the most senior commanders to persuade their civilian colleagues to adopt their strategic viewpoint. In this, they were not especially successful. Moltke pressed for war sooner rather than later at the Neues Palais in December 1912, but although the Kaiser seemed briefly to endorse the staff chief's view, nothing came of it. Paradoxically, the absence in Berlin of a collective decision-making organ like the Council of Ministers in St. Petersburg made it more difficult for the militaries to build a political pressure group in support of their ideas, using military requisitions as a battering ram to smash through fiscal restraints. In Paris, the most powerful civilian and military officials worked closely together to achieve increased expenditure in support of a more offensively oriented strategy. In Germany, such deep institutional and constitutional barriers separated the military and civilian chains of command that this kind of synergy was far harder to achieve. There was no German equivalent of Krivoshein, and Chancellor Bethmann-Hollweg was a more powerful and formidable figure than his Russian counterpart Vladimir Kokovtsev. After the Agadir crisis of 1911, Bethmann consistently pursued a policy focused on inconspicuous and pragmatic collaboration with Britain and Russia. "Our most urgent task is a modus vivendi with England," he declared in December 1911. "We must keep France in check through a cautious policy towards Russia and England," he wrote in March 1913. Naturally, this does not please our chauvinists and is unpopular, but I see no alternative for Germany in the near future. Preventive war arguments thus never became the platform for policy in Germany before 1914. They were rejected, like Conrad's even more vociferous demands in Vienna, by the civilian leadership. Neither in 1905, nor in 1908-9, or 1911, when conditions were in fact much more favourable from the German standpoint than they would be in the summer of 1914, did the German government consider launching a preventive war. In the Agadir affair of 1911, it was the British, rather than the French or the Germans, who did most to militarize the crisis. And in the winter crisis of 1912-13, it was French rather than German policy that came close, though only intermittently, to embracing the notion of preventive war. Berlin was far more restrained in its advice to Vienna than Paris was in its communications with St. Petersburg. As for the Kaiser, though prone to outbursts of belligerent rhetoric, he panicked and counseled caution whenever a real conflict seemed likely, to the endless frustration of the generals. Wilhelm remained hopeful of a long-term accommodation with Britain. His remarks during 1913 suggest that he continued to regard an Anglo-German war as unthinkable. He also remained confident that German military prowess would deter Russia from an armed intervention in a conflict between Austria and Serbia. This complacency prompted the hawkish General Falkenhayn, soon to become Minister of War, to observe in a letter of January 1913 that the deluded faith of the political leadership, including Wilhelm, in the possibility of a lasting peace, left Moltke standing alone in his struggle with the Kaiser for a more aggressive foreign policy. The Kaiser's refusal to embrace preventive war thinking became the bête noire of a growing military opposition. The primacy of the civilian over the military leadership remained intact. Yet this does not mean that we should discount pro-preemption arguments as irrelevant to the actions of German or other policymakers. On the contrary, preventive war logic exerted a stealthy but important pressure on the thinking of the key decision-makers during the crisis of summer 1914. Germans on the Bosphorus. German policymakers, other ones than those preoccupied with arming Germany for a future war on two fronts, also explored the possibilities of a future in which Germany would pursue its interests while avoiding the incalculable risks of war. An influential group of functionaries, including the State Secretary of the Colonial Office Bernhard Dernburg, Ambassador Paul Metternich in London, and his colleague Richard von Kühlmann, later State Secretary of the Foreign Office in Berlin, continued to press for a policy of détente and concessions vis-à-vis London. This line of thought found formal expression in the political tract A German World Policy Without War, published anonymously in Berlin in 1913, but written by Richard Plen, who had worked closely with Kühlmann in London. And there were potential partners for such a policy in Whitehall, especially among members of the anti-Grey liberals, such as Colonial Secretary Lewis Harcourt. Despite the collapse of the Haldane mission, the quest for détente with Britain had yielded real fruits. A new round of negotiations over colonial questions opened in the summer of 1912. In April 1913, the two states signed an agreement on the African territories, currently under the authority of the Portuguese Empire, whose financial collapse was expected imminently. The agreement was never ratified because of differences between Berlin and London on when and how to publicize its contents, but it signaled a willingness in principle on both sides to demarcate spheres of interest and collaborate in excluding third parties from intervening. Given the very limited options available to Germany in the global imperial arena and the relatively closed situation in the Europe of the Alliance blocs, one region above all attracted the attention of statesmen interested in a world policy without war, the Ottoman Empire. German policy had traditionally been rather restrained in this part of the world, where inter-imperial rivalries were especially fierce. But during the 1880s, Berlin became more active. It was encouraged to do so by the government in Constantinople, which, alienated by the British occupation of Egypt, 1882, actively courted partners in Berlin. German banks, construction firms, and railway companies began to move into the less developed areas of the Sultan's empire, acquiring concessions and spheres of interest. Work on a largely German-financed and built Anatolian railway began in 1888 to link Constantinople with Ankara and Konya. Both lines were complete by 1896. Government support for these ventures, initially rather fitful, gradually became more pronounced and consistent. By 1911, it was possible for the German ambassador in Constantinople to speak of the empire as a German political, military, and economic sphere of interest. By investing in the Ottoman lands, especially in crucial infrastructural projects, the Germans hoped to stabilize the Ottoman Empire in the face of the threat posed to it by the other imperial powers, most importantly Russia. And should the collapse of the Ottoman Empire open the door to a territorial partition among the world empires, they wanted to be sure of a seat at the table where the spoils were divided. High hopes were invested in the Anatolian Railway. The Ottoman authorities in Constantinople intended to pacify and integrate the Anatolian Wild East, still prey at this time to the depredations of Circassian bandits, and to civilize the most underdeveloped of the Ottoman lands. They viewed Anatolia through Orientalist spectacles as a colony in need of improvement. New food crops were introduced in the areas opened up by the railway, including some, such as sugar beet and potatoes, that turned out to have been grown in the region for some time, and efforts were made to establish industrial plants, such as esparto grass, which could be processed to manufacture paper. Many of these projects made it no further than the experimental stage, either because the climate and soils were unsuitable, or because the locals refused to adopt the new techniques. For the inhabitants of rural Anatolia, some of whom brought bushels of grass to the stations to feed the horses that they had assumed would be pulling the trains, the appearance of steam locomotives was an unforgettable sensation. In Germany, too, the Anatolian venture had an inflaming effect on the colonial imagination. Some pan-Germans saw Anatolia, improbably enough, as a possible field for future German mass settlement. Others were more interested in access to markets, trade routes, and raw materials. Railways, like hydroelectric dams in the 1930s to 50s, or space travel in the 1960s, held a special place in the imperial imaginary at the turn of the 20th century. In Britain and the Cape Colony, plans were afoot to build a Cape to Cairo railway. At around the same time, the French were planning a rival West-East African super railway from Senegal to Djibouti. The history of the great global telegraph networks had already established the intimate connection between infrastructure and power, especially in those areas of the British Empire where telegraph stations were miniature outposts of imperial authority and discipline. There was thus consternation in 1903 when it became known that a company owned by German banks had been entrusted by the Ottoman government with the construction of a gigantic railway line that would extend from the Ankara end of the Anatolian Railway via Adana and Aleppo across Mesopotamia to Baghdad and, ultimately, Basra on the Persian Gulf. The project, which in theory would one day make it possible to travel by train directly from Berlin to Baghdad, met with suspicion and obstruction from the other imperial powers. The British were concerned at the prospect of the Germans acquiring privileged access to the oil fields of Ottoman Iraq, whose importance was growing at a time when the British Navy was planning the transition from coal to oil-fired ships. They feared that the Germans, freed through a land route to the east from the constraints imposed by British global naval dominance, might come to threaten Britain's preeminence in colonial trade. Although the route of the railway had been laid, at great inconvenience to the engineers and investors, as far as possible from Russian areas of interest, St. Petersburg still feared that it would place the Germans in a position to pose a threat to Russian control of the Caucasus and northern Persia. These projections of strategic anxiety appear far-fetched in retrospect, but they had a powerful hold on policymakers at the time, who tended to assume that economic investment would inevitably be followed by geopolitical leverage. Kaiser Wilhelm II's intermittent pro-Ottoman and pro-Islamic political posturing did nothing to allay such suspicions. In 1898, during his second visit to the Middle East, Wilhelm had delivered an impromptu toast in the city hall of Damascus that was cited in newspapers around the world. "May His Majesty the Sultan and the 300 million Muslims living around the world who see in him their caliph be assured that at all times the German Kaiser will be their friend." This effusion, the result of a euphoric mood brought on by the cheering of the Arab crowds, awakened fears of a Germany aligned with the forces of pan-Islamism and Arab nationalism that were already gaining ground in the British and Russian empires. In reality, German economic involvement was not disproportionate in international terms. There was intensive German investment in electrical utilities, agriculture, mining, and municipal transportation. Trade between Germany and the Ottoman Empire was on the increase. Yet the Germans still, in 1913, lagged behind Britain, France, and Austria-Hungary in imports from, and behind Britain and Austria-Hungary in exports to, the Ottoman Empire. French investments still exceeded those of Germany by around 50%. Nor could it be said that some German capital behaved more aggressively than the European and British competition. In the race to secure strategic control of the prized oil concessions of Mesopotamia, for example, British banks and investors, backed by London, easily maneuvered the Germans into positions of disadvantage with a combination of hard bargaining and ruthless financial diplomacy. Even in the sphere of railway building, where more than half of all German investment was tied up, 340 million gold francs, the French contribution was comparable in size, 320 million gold francs. While the French owned 62.9% of the Ottoman public debt administered by an international agency on behalf of the empire's creditors, Germany and Britain held roughly equal shares of most of the rest. And the most powerful financial institution in Constantinople, the Banque Impériale Ottomane, which, in addition to controlling the lucrative tobacco monopoly and numerous other enterprises, also possessed the exclusive right to issue banknotes in the Ottoman Empire, was a Franco-British enterprise, not a German one. It was also an instrument of French policy, in the sense that its credit and fiscal operations were steered from Paris. After long negotiations, a sequence of international accords did much to neutralize tension over the Baghdad Railway. A Franco-German agreement of the 15th of February 1914 marked out the boundaries between the spheres of interest of the key German and French investors. French capital was crucial to the financing of the project. And on the 15th of June, the Germans were able to overcome British objections by conceding, among many others, British control of the crucial Basra-Persian Gulf section of the future railway, a concession that robbed the project of much of its supposed geostrategic value to the Germans. These and other episodes of collaboration, where political questions were laid aside in the interest of securing pragmatic arrangements in the economic sphere, gave reason to hope that the Ottoman Empire might indeed provide the theatre for a world policy without war that would in time create the basis for a partnership of some kind with Britain. Much more serious than the wrangling over control of the Baghdad Railway was the crisis that broke in December 1913 over the arrival of a German military mission in Constantinople. After its disastrous campaigns in the Balkans, the Ottoman government looked desperately for foreign assistance in strengthening its armed forces through root and branch reform. Although the Ottoman military command did briefly consider inviting a French military mission, the Germans were the more obvious partners. German military advisers had been a fixture in Constantinople since the late 1880s and 90s, when Golz Pasha had run training courses for Turkish officer cadres. But this mission was to be on a larger scale than earlier efforts. Its chief was to be assigned a command role. The refusal to cede such authority to the previous advisers was seen as a key reason for the failure of earlier efforts, and would be responsible for the entirety of Ottoman military education, including the training of the general staff. He also possessed unlimited powers of military inspection, and he would be accompanied by a phalanx of 40 German officers on active service. Most importantly, as commanding general of the Ottoman First Army Corps, he was also to be responsible for the defense of the Straits and of Constantinople itself. The man chosen to head up the mission was Lieutenant General Liman von Sanders, commander of the 22nd Division in Kassel. Since neither the Kaiser nor Chancellor Bethmann-Hollweg saw this mission as a fundamental departure from previous practice, and since the details were drawn up internally between the Ottoman and German military commands, it was not viewed as a matter for formal diplomatic negotiation with Russia. Instead, the Kaiser raised the question informally in May 1913 during a meeting with Nicholas II and George V, on the occasion of the wedding of Princess Victoria Louise of Prussia and Prince Ernst August of Hanover. Neither sovereign raised any objections to the planned mission. No mention was made of it when Bethmann and Sazonov met for brief talks in November 1913, the Chancellor assuming that Sazonov had been informed by the Tsar. When news began to leak out about the details of Liman's assignment, however, there was a roar of protest from the Russian newspapers. Underlying the public outrage, which was encouraged by the Russian Foreign Ministry, was the apprehension that the mission would not only strengthen German influence in Constantinople, increasingly seen as a strategic choke point of immense importance for Russia, but would renew the viability of the Ottoman Empire itself, whose collapse and partition were becoming an axiomatic element in Russian strategic thinking on the near and medium-term future. The Russian military plenipotentiary in Berlin described Liman in a letter to the Tsar as a very energetic and self-aggrandizing character. It did not help that the Kaiser, in a secret audience for the members of the mission, had urged its departing members to build him a strong army that would obey my orders and form a counterweight to the aggressive designs of Russia. These words were passed back to St. Petersburg by the Russian military attaché in Berlin, Bazarov. Sazonov, therefore, saw in the German mission a matter of eminently political significance. There was consternation in St. Petersburg. "I have never seen them so excited," Edward Grey confided to the German ambassador in London. Why did the Russians react so strongly to the Liman mission? We should recall that even during the crises of 1912-13, when Sazonov's policy had appeared to prioritize the Balkan Peninsula over a bid for control of the Dardanelles, the Straits had remained at the center of Russian strategic thinking. The importance of the Straits to Russian economic life had never been more obvious. In the years 1903-12, 37% of Russian exports passed through the Dardanelles. The figure for wheat and rye exports, both vital to Russia's cash-hungry industrializing economy, was much higher, at around 75-80%. The urgency of this linkage was driven home by the two Balkan wars. From the beginning of the conflict, Sazonov made numerous representations, both to the belligerent states and to the Allied great powers, to the effect that a closure of the straits to neutral commercial shipping would inflict enormous losses on Russian exporters, and that measures must be avoided that might bring this about. As it happened, the wars did cause two temporary closures of the Dardanelles, seriously disrupting Russian trade. Disruptions were one thing. The permanent loss of influence in an area of crucial geopolitical interest was another, much more serious concern. In the summer of 1911, Sukhumlinov had worried lest the Germans establish a foothold on the Bosphorus. "Behind Turkey," he warned, "stands Germany." In November 1912, it was the Bulgarians who seemed close to seizing Constantinople. At that time, Sazonov had instructed Izvolsky to warn Poincaré that if the city were captured, the Russians would be obliged to deploy the entire Black Sea fleet there immediately. During the weeks that followed, Sazonov discussed with the General Staff and the Admiralty plans for a landing of Russian troops to protect Constantinople and project Russian interests. He rejected a British proposal to internationalize the Ottoman capital on the grounds that it was likely to dilute Russian influence in the region. New plans were drawn up to seize Constantinople and the entirety of the Straits by force. In a paper prepared for Kakovtsev and the service chiefs on the 12th of November, Sazonov explained the advantages of a Russian seizure. It would secure one of the centers of world trade, the key to the Mediterranean Sea, and the basis for an unprecedented development of Russian power. Russia, he argued, would be established in a global position that is the natural crown of her efforts and sacrifices over two centuries of our history. In a revealing allusion to the importance of opinion, Sazonov concluded that an achievement of such grandeur would unite government and society behind an issue of indisputable pan-national importance, and thereby bring healing to our internal life. Russia had lost millions of rubles in trade during the recent disruption of the Straits, Sazonov pointed out to Nicholas II on the 23rd of October 1912. Imagine what would happen if, instead of Turkey, the Straits were to go to a state which would be able to resist Russian demands. Anxieties on this score ensured that, throughout the summer and autumn of 1913, the Russian Black Sea Naval Command remained focused on the possibility of an imminent seizure of the Dardanelles. Russia, Captain A.V. Nemitz of the Naval General Staff declared, must be prepared to accomplish the capture of the Straits in the immediate future. Concerns about the growing strength of the Turkish fleet heightened the urgency of these proposals. The Turks had already ordered one dreadnought battleship, which was currently under construction in Britain, and two more were ordered in 1912-14, though none had arrived by the time war broke out. Nevertheless, the prospect of local Turkish superiority over Russian naval strength filled the navalists in St. Petersburg with a foreboding that was in part no more than the inversion of their own imperial designs. The Russians, and Sazonov in particular, who was closely involved in all the relevant strategy discussions, were thus already highly sensitized to the question of control over the Straits when the Liman von Sanders mission arrived in Constantinople. What the foreign minister found particularly objectionable was the German command role. The Germans were at first reluctant to back down on this question, because the failure to assign real authority to previous generations of military advisers was seen, by both the Germans and the Ottomans, as the core reason for their failure to produce genuine reform. Experience suggested that the right to issue instructions was insufficient without the power to see that these were implemented. Sazonov was unimpressed and sought to step up pressure on Berlin. He proposed to London and Paris a joint note from the Entente powers, objecting in the strongest terms to the mission, and closing with the implicit threat that, if Germany were to secure such a primacy in Constantinople, then the other powers would see themselves obliged to act in accordance with their own interests in Turkey. This initiative was not a success, mainly because the Russians were alone in viewing the Liman von Sanders mission as a threat to their vital interests. Neither the French nor the British military attaché in Constantinople was especially alarmed at Liman's arrival. It made sense, they reported, for the Germans to insist on tighter controls after the failure of previous missions to achieve anything of lasting value. Grey pleaded that the urgency of the Irish question and the difficult internal condition of the country ruled out any direct British involvement in the issue. In any case, the British were less concerned about German advances in Turkey than about the growing dominance of French capital. Turkey's independence is a vanishing quantity before the advances of the French financiers, Sir Lewis Mallet told Edward Grey in March 1914. In a furious speech to the House of Commons on the 18th of March, the Conservative MP Sir Mark Sykes, expert on Ottoman and Middle Eastern affairs, warned that the stranglehold of French finance in Ottoman Syria would ultimately pave the way to annexation. Then there was the fact that there was already a British naval mission operating on the Bosphorus, the scope of which had been extended by the arrival in 1912 of Admiral Arthur Limpus, whose contract of employment stated that he was commandant de la flotte. In addition to overseeing improvements to the training and supply of the Ottoman Navy, Limpus coordinated the deployment of torpedo boats and the laying of mines in the Turkish Straits, one of the most important means by which access was denied to foreign warships. Limpus understood his mission in a broad political sense. His correspondence with the Ottoman Admiralty covered not just questions of technical modernization, procurements, and training, but also broader issues of strategic importance, such as the degree of naval strength required to make it hazardous for the Russians to move troops across the Black Sea. In other words, his presence in Constantinople served aims closely analogous to Liman's. Limpus viewed with sage equanimity the Anglo-German condominium over Ottoman sea and land-based defence. England has the widest experience in naval matters and as regards shore establishments, he told the Ottoman Admiralty in June 1912. Germany has the most powerful army, and it is also believed to be the most efficient. I feel sure it has been most wise to get German advisers for everything connected with the army. I feel sure it will be most wise to obtain all advisers on naval matters from England. Sazonov therefore found it difficult to stir in his Entente partners the outrage felt in Russia at the arrival of the German mission. Grey rejected the threatening joint note proposed by Sazonov, and suggested instead a much more innocuous inquiry to Constantinople as to the scope of the German mission. Notwithstanding Delcasse's vigorous nodding in St. Petersburg, the Quai d'Orsay was even less enthusiastic than the British Foreign Office, because it discerned in the language of Sazonov's menacing joint note the prospect of a comprehensive dissolution of Asiatic Turkey, with potentially disastrous consequences for French financial interests. Paris thus preferred to support Grey's more ironic proposal. In other words, too many different forms of imperial ambition and paranoia were focused on the faltering Ottoman Empire to permit the Entente powers to rally together against one supposed threat. Nevertheless, the Liman episode triggered a dangerous escalation of the mood among the key Russian policymakers. Sazonov was furious at the lukewarmness of the British and French reactions to Russia's protests. In a telegram of the 12th of December 1913, to the Russian ambassador in London, he spoke bitterly of his declining trust in the effectiveness of British support, adding that the lack of solidarity between the powers of the Entente arouses our serious concern. In a report to the Tsar of the 23rd of December, he adopted an openly militant position. He urged that joint military measures should be prepared immediately and coordinated with France and Britain. The Entente powers should seize and occupy certain points in Asia Minor and declare that they would stay there until their aims were met. Of course, such a dramatic initiative risked triggering European complications, but it was more likely that a posture of firm resolve would have the desired effect of forcing a German climb-down. Giving in, on the other hand, could have the most fatal consequences. A summit conference should be convened to discuss the issues arising from the Lehman affair. The conference, which opened on the 13th of January 1913, was chaired by Premier Vladimir Kakovtsev. Also present were Sazonov, Minister of War Sukhomlinov, Chief of Staff General Zhilinsky, and Naval Minister Grigorovich. The meeting began with a discussion of the coercive measures required to pressure Constantinople into withdrawing its request for the German military mission. The notion that economic sanctions could be used to apply pressure to the Ottoman government was dismissed. These would also hurt the very extensive French financial interests in the Ottoman Empire and strain the bonds of the Entente. An alternative was the armed seizure by Entente forces of key Ottoman strongposts. The crucial precondition, Sazonov pointed out, was French support. Kakovtsev argued, as usual, against all this fighting talk, pointing out that war was simply too great a risk. Throughout the meeting, he strove to impose a moderate and reasonable tone on the proceedings. Rather than acting in a spirit of pique with ad hoc reprisals, it was important, he suggested, to establish exactly the limits of what Russia would tolerate and what it would not. The Germans, Kakovtsev observed, were looking for a way of escaping from the situation created by the Russian demands, and had already expressed their readiness to make concessions. It was thus crucial to avoid categorical declarations of an ultimative character that would force them to harden their own position. But this time the Prime Minister was challenged in chorus by Sukhomlinov, Sazonov, Grigorovich, and Zhilinsky, who argued that the likelihood of a German armed intervention was minimal, and that, if the worst should come to the worst, war, though undesirable, was nonetheless acceptable. Minister of War Sukhomlinov and Chief of Staff Zhilinsky both categorically declared the full readiness of Russia for a one-to-one war with Germany, not to mention a one-to-one war with Austria. These drastic scenarios became irrelevant because the Germans quickly backed down and the crisis passed. Alarmed by the intensity of the Russian reaction and urged to conciliate by London and Paris, the Berlin government agreed to assign Lehman to the Sultan's army. He remained Inspector General, but his promotion to Field Marshal of the Ottoman Empire meant that he could relinquish his command of the First Army Corps without loss of face. The Lehman von Saunders affair never flared into a continental war, but it was, in retrospect, a revelatory moment. It showed, firstly, how belligerent the thinking of some of the Russian policymakers had become. Sazonov, in particular, had moved from the vacillations of his early period in office towards a firmer and more Germanophobic stance. He had begun to construct a narrative of German-Russian relations that left no room for an understanding with Berlin. Russia had always been the docile, peace-loving neighbor, and Germany the duplicitous predator, bullying and humiliating the Russians at every opportunity. Now the time had come to stand firm. The power of such narratives to shrink policy horizons should not be underestimated. And the repeated assurances from Paris had clearly left their mark. At the conference of the 13th of January, Sazonov observed that, although it was unclear how the British would react to a war between Russia and Germany, it was certain that in the event of a war with Germany, the French would offer active assistance, even to the ultimate. The French ambassador, Monsieur Delcasse, Sazonov reported, had recently assured him that France would go as far as Russia wished. As for Britain, while there might be some hesitation in London at first, it was beyond doubt that she would intervene as soon as the resulting conflict developed to the disadvantage of France and Russia. The Tsar, too, began to take a firmer view. In a conversation with Ambassador Buchanan at the beginning of April 1914, he observed that it was commonly supposed that there was nothing to keep Germany and Russia apart. This, however, was not the case. There was the question of the Dardanelles, where the Tsar feared that the Germans were working to shut Russia into the Black Sea. Should Germany attempt such a thing, it was essential that the three powers of the Entente unite together more closely to make it clear to Berlin that all three would fight together against German aggression. For the Germans, on the other hand, the ferocity of the Russian reaction to the Lehman mission, coupled with bitterness over the German capitulation to Russian demands, created the sense that an unbridged gulf now separated Berlin and St. Petersburg. "Russian-Prussian relations are dead for all time," lamented the Kaiser. "We have become enemies." For the dovish Kokovtsev, the Lehman von Sanders affair brought the final unravelling of his already enfeebled position. He had been in France negotiating the new railways loan when the crisis had broken. Sazonov asked him to go to Berlin to negotiate with the Germans. Kokovtsev's reports of those conversations revealed that he felt acutely the extent to which he had been sidelined. He had found it difficult, he commented in a thinly veiled complaint to Sazonov, to make his German interlocutors understand the peculiarities of a Russian system that assigned such limited powers and prerogatives to the chairman of the Council of Ministers. Kokovtsev's chairmanship at the conference of the 13th of January was the last occasion on which he would play such a role. At the end of January 1914, he was dismissed by the Tsar both as chairman of the Council of Ministers and as Minister of Finance. Kokovtsev's dismissal was a defeat not just for the man, but for the policy, and more generally for the cautious and conservative tendency in Russian politics that he represented. The new chairman of the Council of Ministers was Gary Mikhin, who was widely viewed as a mere figurehead, an old man, as Sazonov later recalled, who had long ago lost not only his capacity for interesting himself in anything but his personal tranquillity and well-being, but also the power of being able to take into account the activities in progress around him. The real powerhouse on the new council was the exceptionally well-connected Krivoshein, who had been coordinating the campaign against Kokovtsev since 1913. Kokovtsev's replacement in finance, P.A. Bark, was a competent but undistinguished figure and a protégé of Krivoshein. Krivoshein was an enthusiastic supporter of the hard line pursued with increasing energy by Sukhomlinov and Sazonov. Without Kokovtsev as the exponent of caution, the balance of influence on the Council of Ministers shifted towards more militant solutions. Finally, the Lehman von Sanders crisis revealed how urgent the Russian preoccupation with the Straits had become. At the same time, it raised troubling questions about how far the Entente partners still were from supporting a Russian bid for untrammeled access to the Straits. Sazonov's doubts on this score were reflected in the rather inconsequential conclusion to the conference of the 13th of January, in which it was agreed, on the one hand, that the Russians should launch, with Entente support, a sequence of increasingly coercive actions against Constantinople, and on the other, that if the Entente continued to withhold its support, the Russians should confine themselves to non-military measures of coercion. The Russians were right to be skeptical about Entente backing. Even after the crisis had passed, the British remained apprehensive at the prospect that Russia would raise the question of the Turkish Straits again in the not-too-distant future. It was difficult, in other words, to imagine a scenario in which the Russians would be able to secure the necessary international backing for a policy aimed directly and openly at securing control of the Straits. This was the problem Charikov had faced in November 1911. when he had explored the possibility of a bilateral deal with the Porte. At that time, Sazonov had opted to disavow his ambassador in Constantinople because he believed a direct bid for the Straits was still premature. He had gravitated instead towards Hartwig, whose militant pan-